The most amazing thing, the creator of heaven and earth, the God who delivered them out of Egypt, declares that he's going to enter into a covenant with these people. It's not a contract. It's a kind of binding agreement between things which couldn't possibly have any relation to one another, save for this kind of device, something which binds together God and man in a promise forever.
Dr. Cass, our purpose for this discussion is to try to discuss something about God and learn about the way that God reveals himself through the text. I think maybe the place to begin is not in the text itself, but to just wrap our heads around how difficult a question this is. And that's in part because of what we readers think we know about God that is not emerged in the text, but that we've learned from elsewhere. Maybe we could just begin with some of the other conceptions of God and clear them away.
Well, I'm not sure we have to finally clear them away, but I think we should acknowledge, and it is a difficulty that stands in the way of anybody who wants a naive, direct encounter with this text, that being a civilization formed by this book and in which teachings about God have been everywhere, that almost no reader can start reading this book without having some preformed conception of what God is or who God is or what should be ascribed to him. I think if you'd ask an average person, they would say, well, I mean, God is eternal. God is unchanging. God is omniscient. God is omnipotent. God is ineffable. God is infinite. All of those things. And it should come as a surprise to a reader reading the book that none of those things are ever predicated about God. In the one place where God actually gives Moses a kind of partial revelation of his so-called qualities, none of those things are listed there. These attributes, by the way, are, strange to say, these are gifts to God of medieval theologians who ascribed those qualities to him for their own, as it were, theological reasons. Although God is the major character in the book of Exodus and indeed in the Bible as a whole, we don't do theology. I mean, we talk about God does things and says things, but there's no place, except perhaps for this couple of very small places with Moses, that there's anything even approaching of what you would call theology, which is to say speech about God. So my recommendation to myself after failing to do this multiple times is, Leon, forget what you think you know about God and be instructed by the text in the following way. The word occurs there on the first sentence of the book of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He's a very big character. We don't know who's speaking. He's talking about something no human being could have witnessed. We'll suspend disbelief. We'll follow along, and maybe the text will teach us how to fill in this placeholder about whom large claims are being made and who does a lot of talking and who does a lot of things. Maybe we can learn from the text itself what's to be said about its leading character.
Now, of course, we've discussed several points along the way when figures from the book of Exodus learn things that had happened in previous generations that were described in the book of Genesis.
Correct.
But for the most part, by and large and for the most part, the figures in Exodus do not know the tales of Genesis as we readers do.
Correct.
And so how should we treat that in this discussion about a character, the central character perhaps, that appears in both books?
Well, I think the reader, look, the people in the story are getting an education of God's revelation through speech and deed. There was some such revelation in the adventures of Abraham, who answered when a voice called him and told him to leave his father's house to a land that he will show him. And then there are a series of adventures in which Abraham comes to know a little bit more who this voice is, and especially what this voice wants of him. God speaks to a few of the other ancestors, but doesn't say very much. In Exodus, the people on the ground, Moses especially, but derivatively the people, and also Pharaoh, to his sorrow, get something of an education about God. The reader has the advantage. The reader can sympathetically identify with all the characters in both Genesis and Exodus and try to have the experience of what would we be learning if we were there. But we also have the narrative sweep of the two books in which we're in on things that nobody in the story is in on. So I think for the reader who is, as I suggest in the introduction of the book, has to regard himself or herself in a way as a vital participant in this story, things will be working on us and happening to us as we read. But I think the beginning is to try to enter into the text through the imaginative participation with the people in the story and hearing what the text says to them and how God reveals himself in the story, first of all to them and secondarily to us.
The very beginning of Exodus, of course, includes a description of the Israelites' new situation in Egypt, where they are where they're enslaved to a pharaoh who does not remember their ancestors.
Correct.
When do we first hear about God and this first revelation of God in Exodus?
Well, the very first mention of him is at the end of the second chapter, where there is a second pharaoh and it turns out he's no better than the last guy. And finally, the Israelites cry out from their oppression. It doesn't say they cried out to God, they just cried out. And then it said, and God heard their cry, and he saw their oppression, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and God knew, and the text breaks off. What he knows, it doesn't say. But the people's crying out from their oppression basically says, okay, now it's going to happen what's supposed to happen. And we expect to find out, beginning just over the horizon, how the plan going forward to do something about this. But the first thing we learn about God is he has a compassionate ear for the suffering. He is loyal in memory to a promise that he made to their ancestors. The people, I suspect, know absolutely nothing about him at this point, very little, if anything.
And even in that narrative disclosure, that God somehow recognizes the plight of this people, right, this covenantal people to whom he's made a promise, there's no further statement that God reacted to them in some way. It's in a way for the benefit of the reader.
Yep. Yeah. The reader is told that God has entered this story hearkening to suffering. They are going to be called to hearken to something else. He sees after he hears. He checks up on what he hears. He's then moved to remember a promise. And the reader is in a way told that God's promise counts for something. That's the first teaching. Compassionate God who's loyal to his people and to his promises.
We readers are clued into the fact that God is somehow present in some sense. But God's actions are not yet manifest in history.
Correct.
Until
the first episode is when he calls to Moses out of the burning bush. And Moses, who goes to the bush with wonder and curiosity, is dumbstruck with awe and is told that he is having here an encounter with the God of his fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, about whom I suspect Moses knew nothing at all also. He's given this large mission that God wants him to go to Pharaoh in Egypt and to bring his people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. And there ensues a small conversation in which Moses is hesitant, but he's not supine. He wants to know something about this voice. And when the voice tells him, "Don't worry, Moses, I will be with you," Moses says, "Look, when I come to the children of Israel and tell them the God of their ancestors has sent me, and they want to know what's his name, what shall I tell them?" So Moses, very quickly, "Yes, it's all right that my ancestors worshipped you, but tell me more. Who or what are you? Tell me your name." And Moses gets an enigmatic non-answer, or a puzzling, to say the least, answer. "Ehyeh asher ehyeh, I am what I am, or as I prefer it, I will be what I will be," which I treat as, "Moses, don't try to capture me in speech. Don't think that you can know me intimately by name or have a name that denotes my essence. I will be what I will be. Pay attention. You'll learn."
Maybe there's more to say about that answer.
Of course.
But maybe you could just explain. You write in the book about the significance of names and what it should mean that Moses would ask for this entity's name. Why are names important? What's this all about?
Well, names are a way of handling the world. General nouns, so that we can recognize things and put them into a kind of universe of intelligibility. Proper names, something a little more, a sign of familiarity, an expression of the beginning of some kind of relationship. To name is also to be able to summon. To summon is a form of trying, in fact, to influence, if not to exercise some kind of control. The name provides a kind of access. I call you by name, John. You perk up. I have your attention. I might be able to ask something of you. It's the most natural thing in the world to ask a newcomer, "What is your name?" But it's also has a certain presumptuous. You sometimes say, "May I ask your name?" If you're being mindful of what a liberty you're in a way taking, and to take it with a deity is a certain act of boldness. And one has to say, whereas Jacob, who wrestled with the angel and at the end of the evening said, "Tell me first your name," and he's rebuked, "Why ask you for my name?" God does not object to Moses's asking the question. He's rather, I think, pleased that he's got a person who really wants to know God and wants, but he has to educate him in the manner in which he's to know him. Moses is a fellow who wants to know the ultimate things. Good. But it's not going to be done through the usual ways in which people, by naming, think they're going to grasp the essence of things. It's a philosophical question getting a non-philosophical answer. And for the time being, Moses, it satisfies him. It's not going to satisfy him forever.
You know, there's a way of... a way of thinking about knowledge that we tend to have inherited from Greek philosophy,
right,
that assumes that in some other realm there is the idea of a thing,
mm-hmm,
and that when we call something by its name, we're thinking of that distillation of its essence.
Mm-hmm.
So that when I refer to the chair you're sitting on, everyone who's listening to our conversation now knows that it's a chair by virtue of the fact that they're imagining something else that's a chair,
right,
and identifies that thing you're sitting on with their picture in their head, mm-hmm, of that thing. In God saying that I will be what I will be, that would seem to be a thoroughgoing rebuke of that kind of epistemology, of that kind of knowing, because God would seem to be suggesting that I, by calling me a name, I do not exist in my fullness in some other place. You, with the faculties of human apprehension, will only come to know me through history in the deeds that I undertake.
That's That's lovely. That's really beautifully said, John. God is not some, and it in a way is a way of destabilizing our reader's expectation that we walk in with an idea of God, which even if we acknowledge we don't know what we're talking about, but we think we ought to know what we're talking about because the words bespeak ideas and point to them and reflect them. And here there's a suggestion that what things are will be learned only through unfolding in time. Not just me, by the way, but also you and also this people. That the story will be what things are will be revealed only temporally and through paying attention.
Maybe we should move ahead to God's manifest presence in Egypt. And there's a number of things to unpack there. But to begin with, where is God first present in Egypt?
I guess in the instructions about Egypt and what Moses and Aaron are to say when they go down there, in the signs and wonders and chastisements that he tells Moses he will apply, in the prophecy that he, with his own mighty outstretched arm and hand, will deliver the children of Israel after the plagues won't have moved Pharaoh very much. But also as the keynote of the adventures in Egypt, he tells Moses that the whole purpose of this display of power through the signs, wonders, and chastisements known as the plagues, he's undertaking this so that the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. The whole enterprise is in fact an epistemological enterprise. Yes, they're going to liberate the people, but the most important thing in addition to the liberation is to bring Egypt, the world's greatest civilization, to bear witness to the superiority of the Lord God of Israel. So he's announcing in advance what's at stake of this. And then when you see what happens in Egypt, you begin to see how that aspiration is fulfilled.
How should one think about the Israelites' own knowledge of God at this point? Is there some kind of implicit understanding that the testimony of the Egyptians itself will carry more weight to the slavish people?
I think I've skipped a step because Moses had tried out this great message on the people, and the people wouldn't hear of it. And Moses, in fact, is even himself despondent. Why are you sending me? Pharaoh won't listen. I can't speak, etc. So it looks as if God adopts the way of working first on Egypt as a way partly to get the world to acknowledge, but when Egypt acknowledges, then the Israelites will be ready to hear as well. To this point, Moses and Aaron performed the signs and wonders. They thought this was wonderful. Then they went in and told Pharaoh, come on, let us out. And Pharaoh says, I don't know this Lord. He tightened the screws. The oppression got worse. The people turned against Moses, and Moses is despondent. It's at that point that God says, first things first, we're going to get the Egyptians to know. And the Egyptians finally do know when they sink in the Sea of Reeds and yell out so that the children of Israel can hear, by the way, we're lost because the Lord is fighting for them, i.e. for you.
Seems to be something crucial introduced into the narrative at this point, which is that somehow God's presence in human affairs is related to God, to mankind's knowledge of God,
yeah,
knowing God in human affairs.
Yeah. Now, this is a theme that's easily overlooked because everybody reads the story of Exodus, a story of national liberation. I think we've said before the word freedom doesn't occur here. And the thing is primarily about coming to know, because coming to know not just once and for all, but coming to pay attention. Coming to pay attention in the first instance to God's might and a few other things that we should talk about what we discover from God in Egypt, but ultimately so that the initial knowledge of God can lead to a new relation with Israel and can lead to an ever deepening and elevating knowledge of God for humankind and for God himself.
Yeah, so in addition to might, what other attributes of God do we discover there?
Well, first of all, we discover that God is in fact stronger than the nature gods of Egypt, who turn out to be powerless, and stronger than Pharaoh's magicians, who can do a few of the things that Moses performs in Egypt. We learn that God tells the truth. I mean, he says this is what he's going to do. It does it. He says it's going to take it away. He takes it away. He not only can destroy things, but he can recreate things. The magicians can't do that.
And may I also interrupt you?
Please.
In that understanding of the truth, we again return to this temporal aspect of God's presence in history. God says that something will happen at a certain time. And we know that it's true only when it happens as it unfurls in history at a later point.
Right. Yeah. Very nice.
Yeah.
We learn that God actually cares for this people. He's going to enter history by having compassion and taking up the cause of a particular people in a way in which no nature God would do. The gods that are worshipped there don't care a fig for any human beings. We also know that he has intellect. Unlike the natural forces, this is a discriminating God. He announces through discriminate speech, he will separate, the plagues will not afflict the places where the children of Israel are. And in the coup de grace, he goes into the household and he can tell the difference between the firstborn and the rest of the household. There's no natural power that can make such a distinction. All of those things appear here.
Of course, in Moses and Aaron's statements to Pharaoh, they, as you were just saying, do not ask for the freedom of the Israelites. They ask that the Israelites be able to serve their God.
Right.
And maybe this is a moment where we could learn something about God by understanding the distinction between service to Pharaoh and service to God.
Yeah, look, my students, particularly when they come out of Egypt and they see that God is a big, mighty guy, they say, look, they're just changed. They're just trading. They're trading one despot for another. They're getting maybe a pharaoh who's on their side, but he's going to be very demanding as well. And it's certainly true that, as we will see, in both cases, they're going to be called to obedience under a law that they don't make. They are going to be held to account under those laws. But there's all the difference in the world. By the way, the reason the question comes up is that the Hebrew word for serving Pharaoh and the Hebrew word for serving God are the same, avodah. And an eved is a slave or a servant, and not all forms of service are servile. Some of them are elevating. So the question is there a difference? Is there something possibly elevating in being an eved or a servant of God? And I think that the text will gradually make it clear that whereas Pharaoh's edicts are products of his will and don't apply to him, the laws that God makes are made for the benefit of all and applied to all equally, not just to the for the many and with exceptions for the privileged few. And also the laws that God gives, although they demand obedience, are in the service of elevating the human being, of dealing with the passions that enslave him from within, fear and despair, greed and lust, vanity, envy, and pride. They teach the habits of courage, of moderation, of generosity, of empathy, of righteousness, and even in the direction of holiness. And finally, they become rules that will be the basis for self-government once they enter their land. There's nothing of all that in Egypt. So serving God is ultimately in the service of the advancement of human dignity, an invitation finally to become holy as God himself is holy, rather than to be a whipping boy to store up treasures in Pharaoh's silos.
Okay, I want to, before we leave Egypt altogether, I do want to return to this question of God's might. God, as is evident in the signs, wonders, and chastisements performed in Egypt, has a certain kind of earthly power.
Right.
And yet, in order to affect that power, he has to recruit these human intermediaries or these human representatives who do his work. I wonder if we could learn something about God by his enlisting mankind to serve his purposes.
That's also wonderful. And I'm not sure I've paused on that sufficiently. The law, God will eventually give a law which will eventually pass into human hands, and he will not be absent, but we'll talk about them when we get there. But the whole project is that God will help those who help him help themselves. And at the beginning, he's got some pretty good helpers in Moses and Aaron. And part of the purpose of what goes on there in Egypt is to educate human beings to begin with the leadership in who it is they're serving and what he might want of them and where he wants to take the people with their help, but also to give them on-the-job training for the tasks that they will then have to take with the people on their own. So that this is not, God will do everything, sit still, pray. This is, go out there, I'm going to instruct you, and gradually what you see is that Moses, to begin with, has to be instructed, do as I tell you. But when he gets the hang of it, he begins to take initiative, and he begins to, as it were, do God's work without having to be told. That, in a way, is the ultimate purpose. I mean, the kind of development of the human soul in a way in which the godly direction can be followed without somebody beating on you or even necessarily whispering in your ear, because it will have been internalized as habitual.
So you've already alluded to the giving of the law. This is, I think, in the Jewish tradition, this is perhaps the way in which it's easiest to know God, most where God's presence is most manifest, by the beneficent generosity and loving kindness of this legislation. But now we've said a lot about the law. One could say much more, but now I'd want to return with a different focus to ask, in particular, what one can learn from the lawgiver, from this law.
Can I step back just a bit to put in a filler beforehand? Because before he gives the law, he not only has gotten them out of Egypt, he's not only punished the Egyptians, they've seen that he's a God of justice and his word again. They've increased their trust in him, and then he becomes a provider in the desert. They go out into the wilderness where there's nothing, and he provides water and food. So he is solicitous, and his world is hospitable to human need. So that when he says at the beginning of offering them the covenant, you have seen how I brought you to me on eagle's wings. And there's a suggestion that he's in a way already a fatherly benefactor, protector, provider. And now he's offering them, not if you just better behave because I tell you, but if you do this, you will become my treasure from among all the nations, for the whole world is mine. You will be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. This is not some pharaoh who wants to keep order, although order has to be kept, as we learn from the Jethro episode, which just precedes. Law is needed to deal with the unruliness of human beings. But the ultimate telos of this law, the ultimate invitation, looks like the invitation to become holy as God himself is holy, and to play a very large national role in the history of the world as God's elected people. So they're in a way learning of his philanthropy. They're learning of his care for them as, I would want to say, after what you said before, as his partners, to carry a certain way for human improvement into the larger world.
And then comes the giving of this fuller explication of instructions to holiness.
Yep.
This law.
Yep. Please. The beginning part of the law looks like American criminal law and torts, capital offenses, bodily injuries, crimes against property, crimes against animals, all of that stuff. And then there's a certain turn, and there's a turn that has to do with certain practices, abominable practices that they expect to encounter when they come into Canaan. And the law turns to deal more with moral matters, spiritual matters, and finally in the direction of being holy men is what the injunction comes to be.
So again, we can say a lot about that law, but that there is such a God who cares that we imitate his ways, that we try to become holy as he is holy.
Yeah.
It tells us something about, I suppose, his affection for us, for the people ratifying this covenant.
Yeah, look, I mean, you could say one of the shocking things in the world from such an invitation is that this is, and this is, by the way, not unrelated to why there are so many exhortations against idolatry. We might come to that. But it's shocking that you have a divinity who's basically saying, be like me, rather than say, know your place. In the Greek tragedy, which is the way the first Homer and Hesiod and then the tragedians proper taught the Greeks about the gods, the stories were of great men who aimed high and were struck down. And one somehow learned that one doesn't advance too far, that the great people are guilty of hubris. Hubris is to somehow be overcome by knowing your place and not aiming high. This God tells this group of ex-slaves, not only are you going to be a nation, but you should aim high. And in the Sabbath teaching, as we talked about it explicitly, the reason for Sabbath observance is precisely to be like God in imitation of his resting on the seventh day. So here, it's the antithesis of Pharaoh, where you push down and suppress. But here there's uplift, there's elevation, and even to be sure, there's going to be a danger that human beings, by their own lights, will think that they're gods, and one has to counter that. But the counter danger is even worse, that people think they're nothing, think they're incapable of rising to the full dignity of being the creature made in God's image. And here the invitation to this people is, let's go for it.
I mean, that's another example of the what is arresting when reading the text as you've counseled that we read it. We know that it is said that all women and men are created in the image and likeness of God.
Right.
But they don't.
Yep. And when Jethro comes and gives Moses instruction about how to fix the problem of judging, and he gives an aristocratic suggestion, find the men of valor and appoint them. I don't know. It says Moses had appointed them. We never hear about them again. But when God comes to give the law is given in the second person, singular, to everybody all at once, men, women, and children, everybody equally addressed in these charges, equally invited to hearken, equally invited to the ultimate spiritual uplift that comes. But personally, you count.
Okay, we've spoken around the issue of idolatry several times. We've referred to this problem in our conversations. But now it's time to try to understand what a jealous God is, what a jealous God means, and why this God should be so preoccupied with forbidding the worship of idols.
Yeah, look, this is, I'm not sure one can get to the bottom of this. And for the longest time, I just sort of took it at face value that this was an attempt to prevent them from making fools of themselves by worshiping non-entities. And if you say, and the translations jealous could also be translated zealous, it's basically, well, let me say two things. I can't say them both at the same time, so I better do one at a time. First of all, it's backing up the sense that this relationship has to be exclusive. The relationship between this people and God should not allow other gods before him. And above all, one shouldn't go around worshiping all kinds of other things that are unworthy of worship. It sounds like the notion of jealous is that God is petulant and he doesn't want his love spread into a triangle. But I think it's rather philanthropic as well. The other things that you would turn to worship are not only not worthy of worship, but in fact, the pursuit of them will be degrading to you. Because in the injunction against idolatry in the Ten Commandments, it's connected with, "For I will visit the iniquities of the fathers on the sons to the children of the third or fourth generation, but of course reward the loyal devotion unto the thousandth generation." Suggestion seems to be that there's a deep connection between idolatry, worshiping false gods or worshiping non-gods, and the tendency to perverse and twisted behavior in human life. And at the calf, we saw it, right? I mean, here is the worship of the calf, and it degenerates into a kind of wild and licentious and orgiastic behavior. So it seems to me that, and here, I think one has to need an expanded view of what idol worship is. In Deuteronomy, Moses will tell them, remember what you heard at Mount Horeb, at Mount Sinai, lest you look around and find animals and worship them, or especially that you look up and see those heavenly bodies and worship them. The natural proclivity of human beings, absent what they heard at Sinai, is to worship nature gods. Nature gods don't teach us anything about right or justice. They don't say anything about incest, cannibalism, bestiality, murder. But the temptation of human beings is not only to worship the things that are explicitly listed there, but to worship all kinds of other things, such as wealth and power and status and prestige. And these are to repose your, to give your heart over to the things which will not actually satisfy the restlessness in your soul, the deep longings of your soul. The teaching against idolatry is necessary because human beings are always, always in danger of idolizing something which in the end will betray their deepest longings. So I think it's absolutely of the essence, and it's in a way one could say it's the big idea of this book. Here is something in which you could repose your longings. Here is something, the cure for your restlessness. It will not let you down.
In its, in God's abiding loyalty to this people, manifest from generation to generation, one can see something other than the temporary and more ephemeral powers, the entities that do not have the characteristics of God, to which we erroneously transfer our worship.
Right. Yeah. No, that's I think it. And what we've seen, and we still haven't got to the end of Exodus. We've seen so far, compassionate, loyal, awesome, powerful, truth telling, punishes injustice, solicitous, provider. His world is hospitable for human need. You don't have to grab all you can and get ahead of your neighbor. There's enough. He is philanthropic for a community as a whole. He gives them the law that will lift them up and is commensurate with their dignity as human beings. And then there's something that's absolutely astounding, which comes when you'd think he'd be done with them. And we've talked about it before.
So in coming to the tabernacle, the institution that God instructs Moses to in turn instruct the Israelites to build so that God can abide in their midst.
Yep.
We are coming to a moment in the history of this people and in the narrative of the text, just after the Israelites have committed this sin of idolatry.
Right.
And so maybe we could enter into this by just understanding, again, with our intention to learn about God, why the instructions for this structure, for God to dwell in their midst, should follow the Israelites' practice of idolatry.
Well, the instructions, you recall, were given before. The instructions were given before the building, according to the instruction, happened after the episode of idolatry smack in the middle. We've said in the previous conversations that among the things that the tabernacle are for is to answer to the people's need and desire to be in touch with what's highest, which if they don't have a way to express it, they're going to express it on their own, aestheticizing and wilding. So part of the purpose of the tabernacle is to cabin, house, and regulate those passions. But it's also a way of answering the people's ill-articulated desire. They really, with Moses absent, who will be in touch with God for us? They have some kind of desire to be in touch. They are still restless. They are still incomplete. And the tabernacle, we learn after the episode with the golden calf, is in fact an answer not just to their weakness, but to something that might in fact fulfill and complete them. And I think we have to say also fulfill and complete God in his desire to be known. One thing that the episode of the golden calf adds, which makes it indispensable, which makes it possible for this to be realized, is they learn, thanks to Moses's, the revelation that Moses gets from God, is he's forgiving. He's gracious and forgiving. And even with the ultimate sin, is willing to renew. In the absence of that, no people would accept this high and demanding mission. Here they can accept it knowing they will fail and there can be forgiveness. It's not in Greek, as in Greek tragedy, you fail and that's the end of the story and you put out your own eyes and disappear. Here you fail, but a forgiving God will re-knit the covenant, and then you have an opportunity now to get to know him better because you've bought in to the mission of following.
And one should also say, incidentally, in imitating the ways of God and in imitating his way of forgiveness, it also enables forgiveness between women and men in a way which is just indispensable for healthy human relations.
Absolutely.
We can see in cultures around the world to this day, cultures that do not have this capacity of forgiveness are far unhealthier cultures than the ones that do.
Yep.
In your analysis of the tabernacle, we've mentioned, but it bears some more unpacking, I think. The language used to describe the construction of the tabernacle echoes other building projects in the Hebrew Bible.
Right.
And you derive some significance in your interpretation of the tabernacle from those echoes. Maybe you could just explain what you read and what you saw.
Okay, well, I guess there are three things that come to mind. One, two positive examples, one negative example. The negative example, apart from the last time they built anything, they built store cities for Pharaoh as slaves. But we remember the first human building project, the City and Tower of Babel, which was a project in which they were going to make their own name by self-recreation and either, as it were, bring heaven into the city or become a god to themselves. And that was struck down as the failure it would ultimately have been by itself. Two other prior building projects were the building of Noah's Ark, which is another place filled with instructions about cubits. And there Noah built letter for letter to what God instructed. And that was an ark that was built to save a saving remnant of humankind after the earth had degenerated into violence. God washed it out and decided to start again with Noah, righteous and simple Noah. The tabernacle has another ark, same word. But it's the Ark of the Covenant, which contains the teachings of the law as has been placed there in the holiest part of the tabernacle, God's law inscribed there, as God's instructions for the building of the tabernacle are realized by human makers dutifully, obediently, the way Noah did that. So that's an echo. But the real, the first building project, and this, by the way, is like Noah's, a cooperative project. God gives the orders, Noah does the work. Here, God gives the orders, the people with the artisans do the work. But there are echoes in the building of the tabernacle of the very first building project, which is the creation of the world told in Genesis 1, where in the beginning of the creation it says, Ruach Elohim hovered over the face of the waters. The Spirit of God hovered over the face of the waters. And lo and behold, in the story of the tabernacle, this phrase occurs from the only other time in which God infuses his Spirit into the artisans who are going to build the ark and the cover and all of the gold work and the candelabra and the table and so on. But there are all kinds of echoes of the seven-day creation story in the building of the tabernacle. And it makes you wonder, what's the relation between the tabernacle and the creation story? And, I mean, lots of people have noticed the echoes. There are dozens of echoes of the first story in here. Many people read this as a kind of microcosm of the creation, but I see it as the antithesis, not the antithesis of the creation, but it is the completion of the need to supply the defect of the creation by culture. And let me try to lay this out if I could. In the creation story, after almost every act of creation, God looked at what he created and saw that it was good. The major exception, there are two, but the major exception is the creation of man. Man is created, but God does not say, and he saw that man was good. And that doesn't mean in context, I don't believe. I have it elaborated at length. We can't do it all here. It doesn't mean that man is not morally good. It means rather that man is yet, all these other things said to be good are fully formed, complete, perfect according to the intention. But man, as he comes from the hand of the Creator, precisely because he is a free being like the Creator, is as yet incomplete. We don't know whether this free being will become complete or whether his freedom will lead him into degenerate and degrading and dehumanizing ways, alone and with his neighbor. So the question of questions beginning at the beginning is, what will it take for man to become good? Left to his own devices, how will men try to find the way to become good if they don't have any instruction? They will use their reason looking around in the world, and especially to the things which strike them as being of the greatest majesty and power, and that's the things aloft. And the other part of Genesis 1, which is a polemic silently against the alleged divinity of the heavenly bodies. The sun and the moon and the stars aren't gods, they're mere creatures. But the other thing that's not said to be good in the first chapter is heaven. I put these two things together. Man is the incomplete being. He will try to find his way in the world by looking to nature and especially to the things of the heavens. The heavens are likewise incomplete, and they can't teach man what he needs to know about being good. For that, he needs instruction. And the instruction comes with giving them a national narrative through slavery and deliverance and a beneficent God. It comes through law and mores at Sinai. But finally, the completion of their education, which would cure their restlessness and their incompleteness, is to be found by having a relationship with their Creator, who says in, this is the most stunning sentence in the whole part of the tabernacle, God makes a confession to Moses. He's going to abide in this tabernacle so they may know him, so that they will know that he is the Lord who took them out of Egypt in order that he might abide in their midst. God tells Moses, they took up with Israel from the beginning for the express purpose that if all went well, he would become not just the Creator God of Genesis 1, not just the Exodus God, not just the law-giving God, but a living daily presence in the place where the people gather and come in expressions of gratitude or contrition to seek a relationship with him. That would be the place where their education would be complete, where they could find the deepest fulfillment. And one has to even suspect it might be good for God, too.
Okay. That is an understanding of the tabernacle, not as an antithesis of creation, but as the completion of creation, the supplement to creation.
It's the antithesis of the cosmos, if by the cosmos you mean the 6 days. God already hinted in the creation story that the 6 days, the word cosmos doesn't occur, it's a Greek word. He saw all that he created and it was very good. But the visible creation is not the whole story. Already from the beginning, we're told there's a seventh day set apart for, which is a holy day. The created order is not holy. Holiness is outside and beyond. And the people who say that this is just the embodiment, as in various Greek temples or in Stonehenge or other places where people wrote the story of the heavens in their buildings, or in the Great Pyramid, which contains all kinds of astronomical lore built into the structure. In Israel, the tabernacle is, it faces not towards the rising sun, but with its back to the rising sun. It's turned its back on nature worship because the real completion is to be found in whatever it is the Sabbath represents. In that sense, it's a completion of the creation, but it's not a microcosm, it's an anti-cosmos. It's a creation by being against cosmic worship.
Okay, and the idea preceded, anticipated earlier in Exodus, but now expressed with even more fullness, that somehow the God's abiding in their midst is enabled by the people's knowledge of God, would seem that the people play an exceedingly important role in God's presence in history. That would suggest that one of those big medievally influenced misconceptions with which we began about God's supreme omniscience and God's supreme omnipotence is here questioned, interrogated, not supported by this text, in which God relies in a very profound way on Israel.
I think that's right, and it is, and this is delicate to talk about. But look, the general formula is easy to say. The existence of Israel and the knowledge of God in the world are interdependent. If there's no God, there's no law. If there's no law, there's no Israel. But if there's no Israel, there's no knowledge in the world of God. And one could say that for God to be fully, and I shudder when I even finish this sentence, for God to be somehow complete, forgive me for saying so, his knowability is incomplete unless there are creatures who know him. And that, it comes out in the business of the sacrifices. What is all this bringing of the sacrifices? Does God really need a lamb slaughtered in the morning and the evening? Yeah, we could give a long explanation of why it's good for the people to come with expressions of gratitude and contrition and remember when they rise up and when they lie down, the bounty of the world, the harm that they do the world just by being alive. But there is a way in which that God doesn't need these things to eat. But there is, if I may say so, an analog. God needs the sacrifice says from human beings to actually live in their world, because if they cease to acknowledge him, if they cease to acknowledge his presence, he goes into eclipse as a living being in our world. So there's mutual interrelation here. There's a kind of what the Israelites learn at the very end is they not only know about God increasingly through his revelation, but they're told that God wants to be known by them. And that is the kind of expression of an intimacy with an open-ended future that we only know on the basis of a good marriage. I mean, to even begin to imagine what this would be like.
Dr. Cass, I don't know if you're interested in pursuing this analogy any further, but we'll try. And if it's sustained by the text, we'll see. But if God is not eclipsed, if his presence in history is manifest as a function of the people's knowing him, and God, moreover, gives all kinds of ways for the people to know him so that he can be manifest in history. And I want to join that recognition with other recognitions about God's professed love for Abraham and his descendants. Are we justified in saying that from the text's point of view, there is a kind of divine loneliness that has to be redeemed by the people's presence and an invitation to that God into the world?
These are, you make me nervous. You should, this question, because to speak in anthropomorphic terms is problematic. And, we talk about the name God in this conversation has come so easily to our lips. We've agreed that we don't have a conception of it. Do we want to say lonely? I prefer the sense that there's something missing in non-recognition, that there's the kind of fullness that God's glory is greatest when people recognize it. What there is when he doesn't, only God knows.
Dr. Cass, thank you.
Thanks very much.